chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now, welcome to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, black performers have always faced special challenges in the United States, and as their performance sometimes required them to demean themselves and maybe reinforce the popular negative images of blacks. Well, if it's bad now, at the turn of the last century, it was especially challenging for black performers and entertainers, athletes, and all that's examined in detail in a new book of essays, Beyond Blackface, African Americans and the Creation of American Popular Culture, 1890 to 1930. And this volume is edited by Carolina's history professor, Fitzhugh Brundage, and he's our guest and has agreed to come talk about this really a brand new time in the formation of American culture for me, Fitz. Thanks for coming to talk to us about it.
Well, I'm glad to be here, and I love to talk about this subject because the people who populate this subject matter are just, or the people who made the culture that this collection is about are just a fascinating group of people, both the people who made it and the people who consumed it, the people who bought it, listened to it, watched it.
It's from the time that I can remember, which is mainly the late 40s and 50s when I started thinking about these things, we've always had white people have always had an attraction for black entertainers, and there's this it's a level of appreciation that's always been there, even among people who you'd have to say were blatant racist, who not only were the kinds of Bull Connor people that were pushing around, but these were people who sincerely believed that African descended people were just not as good as white people. I mean, in terms of their intellectual capability and their whole sort. I mean, they really just genuinely believe this. And so it was amazing that black performers got so much attention from whites, even during this time at the turn of the century when the racism was just going wild in America.
Well, your point there about racist attitudes, it gets to the heart of the challenge for these black artists because, as you said, even the most hardened white racist might believe that African Americans were inferior to whites in every regard except they were really good musicians or they were really good dancers. But that idea rested on the assumption that dancing, for example, or music was somehow this innate African American attribute. And it depreciated, if you will, the artistry of the African-American performers themselves. And it also tended to, if you will, force African-American performers into certain roles that fulfilled white expectations of what a white performer should a black performer should be like. So it was one thing for a African-American performer to dance in a style that whites thought of as African, if you will. But it would be another thing for an African-American dancer to dance in a style more commonly associated with the high culture forms of Europe or elite America. And so for those black artists who aspired to do whatever their creativity allowed them to do, that is to defy expectations, it was a real challenge for them.
Well, no, it brings back memories again. Going back, I can't go back all the way to the time of your writing, but I can go back close enough to it so that some of the things ring really true. Like in our culture, in our family, there was a high level of appreciation for Negro spirituals. Mm-hmm. There was this idea that was really cool to listen, to appreciate, to praise, and to talk about the majesty of this Negro experience. And just as you say, yet if some of the singers in the church choir also were aspiring opera singers or aspiring to be in the mainstream of American high culture, we'd say, well, now, wait a minute, you know, that's probably, you know, they should stay where they belong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that was a challenge. One of the figures that looms large in the volume is an African-American woman dancer named Aida Overton Walker. And she came of age in the 1890s when African Americans got their first opportunity to perform on the stage as dancers in real significant numbers and in a kind of prominent venues. And initially, African American dancers tended to dance in black revues, that is the kind of even the antecedent, if you will, to vaudeville shows. And there were certain dances that African American dancers would do in these black revues, and they tended to build on antebellum dances like the cakewalk, which became a craze in the late 19th century. Well, Ada Overton Walker had greater aspirations than just to be a cakewalk dancer. And so over time, she gradually increased her roles and expanded the choreography that she performed until by the teens, the last few years before she died in 1914, she was dancing in a style that was very close to what was then, I guess you would call, a form of modern dance, which was completely unprecedented for an African-American dancer. And had she not been so gifted, so beautiful, so talented, undoubtedly there would have been much more criticism of her for deviating from the expected roles of an African-American dancer.
Were African in these in these revues, black revues, or what did they call them?
Black shows.
Yeah. And was this strictly for a black audience, strictly for a white audience, for mixed audiences?
It gets very interesting. One of the most remarkable of the sort of black touring troupes of the 1890s was one built around a woman, a black woman, who would have been an opera singer of the highest caliber had she been white. But there was no possibility for her to have a career. So she went by the name of the Black Patty, that is the Black Patty, counterpart to the White Patty, and she toured with the Black Patty Troubadours. And so she would come out and sing arias, and she would sing opera. But between or around her performances would be dance performances, including by Ada Overton Walker, who is part of the Black Patty Troubadours. There would be skits, comedy skits. So it's just the whole entertainment package. And that troupe, the Black Patty Troubadours, performed all over the U.S., I suspect largely to black audiences, but not exclusively. But she toured Cuba, Argentina, all over South America, went to Australia, was wildly popular in Australia, and contributed to the popularity of blackface in Australia. Not that she performed in blackface. Blackface minstrelsy became popular in Australia going all the way back to the gold rush, because Australians had been exposed to minstrelsy in the United States during the California gold rush, and then they returned to Australia for the Australian gold rush of the 19th century and brought with them minstrelsy. In any case, there was already an appetite for minstrelsy of, that is, whites performing black music. But Black Patty went over there and gave them the real thing. And Black Patty's troubadours also performed in Europe. So all of this is to say that in the United States, some of these black revues probably had largely black audiences, but overseas they had almost exclusively white audiences.
And were they strong enough economically to get rich? Did these guys get richer? Was there a level of, I don't want to call it exploitation, but just that the money wasn't there and the producers took their share and that these guys turned out poor? Or how did it work?
Well, it varies. As you would imagine, I think, not being a professional entertainer, but having read a lot about them, there are always those entertainers who come out ahead, and then there are a lot more who don't. In the case of these black performers, I think Black Patty did pretty well for herself. Ada Overton Walker and her husband George Walker and George Walker's partner, Bert Williams, all did quite well. Burt Williams himself at his peak was probably making, I just know approximately, I don't know the exact amount, but in the 19-teens he was making $50,000 a year, which I off the top of my head I would guess would put him in the neighborhood that must be now probably $400,000 to $450,000 a year. So in the days, in that era when the average American was making about $1,000 a year, Burt Williams was doing very, very well. But then there are others like Scott Joplin, of course, the arguably the greatest of all the ragtime composers. He composed music that was wildly popular. He made some money off of the sheet music, but he didn't record, and sheet music was very easily copied without paying copyright, without paying royalties. So he actually died impoverished and in obscurity in 1917.
Well, I want to talk some more about Scott Joplin based on your book. We're visiting with Fitzhugh Brundage about the book that he edited, Beyond Blackface, African Americans and the Creation of American Popular Culture, 1890 to 1930. He and I'll be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Professor Fitzhugh Brundage of the History Department of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's edited a book published by UNC Press called Beyond Blackface. Not only did he edit it, but he wrote the lead essay and sort of the comprehensive essay, which is an introduction to this phenomena that took place around the turn of the century of the black artists and entertainers having a profound influence, but a complicated one on American culture. We were talking about Scott Joplin when we took a break, and Scott Joplin's probably the best known name of the African American prominent performers and entertainers of that era. There are others that we remember?
Well, I think the funny thing about Scott Joplin is if we were having this conversation in 1965, which of course we wouldn't have, but if we had been, I doubt I would have heard of Scott Joplin, or you would have heard of, maybe you had, but Scott Joplin disappeared until, if you remember the movie The Sting.
What was the name of the movie?
The Sting came out.
Yeah, The Sting came out. And so that was what brought Scott Joplin back.
Even though that movie, it's totally anachronistic that the music to that movie is ragtime, because if you remember, it's set in the 20s, right? The Depression?
Yeah, I don't know. It's in the Prohibition era, I guess.
So by which point ragtime was already passé. But for whatever reason, they elected to use ragtime for the soundtrack to that movie, and that brought the Maple Leaf Rag and the Entertainer back into the kind of vernacular. And then what's really interesting is Scott Joplin, one of his goals in his life was to establish ragtime as America's classical music, if you will, as the equivalent of Brahms or Bach. And it didn't work for reasons we can discuss. He was unable to do that. But the interesting thing is after The Sting came out and it became very popular, then Scott Joplin became part of not exactly the classical repertoire, but there are classically trained pianists who perform Scott Joplin. It's challenging music, and if you're a virtuoso piano player, you can have fun with ragtime, and that was always Scott Joplin's view. Shall we say 50 years after his death, half century after his death, his aspirations in a way were fulfilled.
Amazing, because for me, I'm not big into music, but and I have to concede that it was The Sting that brought it, looking back, brought it to my attention. But now it's such a part of it gets me moving, mm-hmm. like other music that gets other people moving doesn't. there's something about the ragtime that makes me wish that his hope would be fulfilled and it'd be a part of the classical repertoire. That would be great. That would be wonderful. Well, now you also talk. Speaking of Scott Joplin, and you've just knocked down my notion that he was famous forever and a famous black entertainer of that era. But you point out in his aspirations led to disappointment in other areas too, in the sense as he strove to be an accepted classical composer. Even he wrote an opera. Did he write an opera? Tell us about that.
He was working on two operas. He was a very well trained musician. He began performing at a very young age, or I should say, he began learning how to play piano at a very young age. And by the time that he was a young adult, he was as well versed as probably any of the popular musicians of his generation. And he grew up in Texarkana and then migrated to Missouri. And when he lived in Sedalia, Missouri, he continued to both study music, to teach it and perform it. And so he had, whereas some of his contemporaries, and certainly contemporaries in other genres, for example, like the blues, which were just beginning to coalesce at the same time that he was beginning to develop ragtime. A lot of blues musicians were not versed in formal composition or musical notation, etc., but Scott Joplin absolutely was. So as his ambitions and his talents expanded, he began to think, as you said, on very large scales. And so one of his last major works was an ongoing effort to compose and then stage, actually perform an opera called Tremonitia, which was is a full-blown opera about African Americans after slavery, essentially making the transition from being an illiterate peasantry into educated citizens. And he did not call it a ragtime opera. He thought of it as an opera. And if you hear a performance of it or if you hear a recording of it, it may surprise you. But on the other hand, as you listen to it carefully, you'll recognize Scott Joplin.
You'll feel the opera or the musical production that we think of as the introducer to the white world about black life, of course, is Porgy and Bess, which is not written by a black person at all. And questions about whether to what extent it really portrayed actual black. That came along a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
And how did it have its antecedents in this era that you write about? Or
no, I suspect that Gershwin, Gershwin was very, very well versed in American popular music, and he had learned his chops, so to speak, playing ragtime as a child, a young adult, teenager, and was a great, he had mastered a variety of black piano styles by the time that he wrote Porgy and Bess. But whether or not he actually knew Tremonitia, I don't know. I think you make a very interesting point because, in a way, Porgy and Bess, as brilliant as it is, there's certain ways in which it seems to flirt with, if not confirm, some white stereotypes of African Americans. The interesting thing about what Scott Joplin was doing with Tremonitia is he, in a way, was an equal opportunity offender in that there are aspects of his opera that, if not offensive, would have been puzzling to white audiences, and likewise, there were aspects of his opera that may have been not necessarily offensive, but just not, shall we say, something that African-American audiences in cities would have been attracted to. The centerpiece of his opera is this lead character, Tremonitia, who's trying to teach a rural black community the values of education and trying to get them to renounce superstition and the old ways. And it's about her struggles and, excuse me, and what put this in the context of Harlem, where Scott Joplin was living in 1915 when he was working on it. The African Americans who were living in Harlem, they were very proud of being in a modern, progressive community. Many of them have migrated out of the South. The last thing they wanted to do was watch an opera about the struggles that they or their parents had gone through to get education, to get out of the thraldom, if you will, of slavery. Likewise, what white American in 1915 who went to opera would want to see an opera about black peasants in the deep rural South who were illiterate, learning how to read and to get educated and worldly? So it was a work that had absolutely no appeal, apparently, to any audience that existed at that time. There was no white opera company that was going to perform it, and there was no black audience that was likely to want to watch that type of opera.
So what happened to it? Did it get performed or did it?
No, it never was performed during his lifetime. He gave one recital, at least one. There may have been others that I don't know about, but at least one in Harlem that was passed without any notice. There was no one at the time who thought that he was at work on some major work. And by the time of his death in 1917, musical tastes had moved on. Ragtime was the music of, to think of it this way, to use a modern analogy, it's like listening to 1980s New Wave or something like that. It's something that—
Passé.
Yeah, you might listen to it for nostalgia, but that's not the hip music. And so seemingly musical taste had passed him by.
Well, we're visiting with Fitz Brundage about the book that he edited and is published by UNC Press called Beyond Blackface, African Americans and the Creation of American Popular Culture, 1890 to 1930. He and I'll be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Fitz Brundage, a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and the editor of a set of essays published by UNC Press called Beyond Blackface, and it's about the impact of African Americans as performers, entertainers, athletes during the period between 1890 and 1930. And we've been talking about Scott Joplin because Fish, you've pointed out to me that he wasn't as famous back then as he is today. He's somebody that we know about. There were others, though, and you've introduced us to a number of entertainers whom you say, if they'd been white in that period, they would be better. I think if I misquote you, correct me, mm-hmm. but that they would have been as famous or more famous than Charlie Chaplin. Which is hard to believe.
Or might have been as famous.
Might have been as famous. Okay.
The figure in particular, I think, who fits in that category is the black vaudevillian, Burt Williams, who was a comedian, a mime, a singer, and probably could have been an actor of a very broad range of roles. And he did. It's important to recognize that he did expand the possibilities for a black performer on the popular stage, but he didn't have a chance to make movies the way he almost certainly would have had he been white.
So movies just bursting out at
just bursting out. So he did. He made, as I understand it, he made two short films. The two films he made were in the era of those one reel films because.
Like a 5 minute or a 30 minute or.
Exactly. Because the multi reel films were literally just developed. And of course, the innovative film of that type was The Birth of a Nation by D.W. Griffith in 1915. So he made one that is extant that we can watch and gives us some glimpse of his ability, particularly as a mime. And being a mime in the era of silent films made all the sense in the world, because if you're a really good mime, you could convey all that could be conveyed on silent films. But I have a feeling that if he had been white, he would have had more opportunities because, one, he could have been in movies that would be so performed, that is shown in both the North and the South. But you weren't going to show a movie with a black lead in the South. That just wasn't going to happen. And two, there weren't black movie companies until the very end of his career. And by then, another figure who looms large in the book is a black filmmaker by the name of Oscar Michaud. And Oscar Michaud started making movies at exactly the same time that Burt Williams made his first movie in 1916. But Michaud really hit his stride, if you will, in the 1920s, by which point Burt Williams was at the very tail end of his career, just before he died.
How do we know that Burt Williams was so great if there are only a couple of short movies and nothing else to really so that we can make a comparison?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, because it, you know, it's easy to say, oh, so-and-so, we don't have any, you know, as you say, we have very little evidence, but he sure was great. Well, there are a couple things. We do have this very brief movie. I don't remember its exact length, but I think it's about 12 minutes. And you see the full range of his performance style in that movie. He also was a remarkable figure in that he was probably the first serious black artist. By serious, I mean as opposed to novelty performer. So the first serious black artist to record widely. Other than Burt Williams, there were very few black musicians who were recorded until after World War I.
These are records, the 78.
Yes, records.
Another device.
Another device, absolutely. So the Edison talking machine goes back to the 1870s, but it was extremely expensive, and very few people had them as a private entertainment device until really about 1900. And then they became cheap enough that you could afford one. I mean, it was a luxury, but middle-class families could start to buy them. And so beginning about 1900, the Edison talking machine really took off, and you could buy a cylinder, which would have one song on it, one three-minute song on it. You could buy a cylinder for anywhere from 50 cents to $1.50. Now, that was a very expensive. So most people would only have a few cylinders in their collection. But the point was, it was becoming, shall we say, it's sort of like color TV in the 1960s. It was expensive, but more and more people started to have it. Well, Burt Williams was, as I say, the first really serious black popular musician to start recording in 1903, and he was very popular. And we know he was very popular, one, just because of the sales, but we also know he was popular because back in that era, they sold the recordings, the cylinders, and then later the flat disc came out. They sold those at prices that varied according to the popularity of the artist. The more popular the artist, the more expensive the disc. And Burt Williams cylinders sold for as much as $1.50, which was the absolute peak. If he had been a lesser artist, they would have sold for 50 cents or a dollar. So some of his songs were very, very popular. The point is, we know they were popular, but we also know we can listen to those. They've all been remastered, and they're all available digitally on CDs now. And you can listen to them, and you see this is a man of very considerable talent, not just as a singer with a very particular style, but also as a lyricist, and he also composed some of the music. And finally, we have the film clip, which we can watch and we can see his ability, but we also know a whole list of people saw him. The most prominent and one, the name that most people will recognize, is W.C. Fields, who was a huge fan of Burt Williams and was convinced that he was really a genius of comedy.
Well, now, one of the great things that historians have the opportunity to do is to pull out underappreciated personalities, as you point out, the Sting did for Scott Joplin. Mm-hmm. Are you Burt's? Are you rescuing him from the dustbin, or has that already been done?
I think that's already been done. I think, and one of the things that happened with Burt Williams And in a way with Scott Joplin is, and this comes back actually to the title of the book, the whole era of blackface entertainment, if you will, became, if you will, it was devalued over the course of the 20th century for a whole variety of reasons. One is, again, it's easy to imagine why African-American performers subsequently who could build on the opportunities that were made available to them by this generation of black performers like Burt Williams and Aida Overton Walker and Scott Joplin. Nevertheless, that they would look back upon it as too close to some of those white stereotypes that they wanted to get away from. So there was respect, but this wasn't anything anybody wanted to go back and revisit. And then I think—
sort of like the— like many contemporary African Americans who are in the upper social strata have the reaction to sort of some of the rap music that portrays African American life in a current African American life in a way that offends African Americans. And so they, while it's wildly popular with white kids, African American adults might just look down on this. Mm-hmm. And it is similarly, high-class African-Americans were uncomfortable with some of the portrayals that the blackface entertainers had brought about.
Absolutely. You're right about that. So that there was, for a certain part of the African-American community, performances by Burt Williams or by Scott Joplin were beneath them. They were listening to Brahms. They were listening to Beethoven. They wanted to see Shakespeare. They didn't want to see this kind of popular entertainment. So there was that portion of the African-American community wasn't interested in it. But I think there was also one of the things that happened after, at the tail end of this period, of course, is the kind of what we give the label, the Harlem Renaissance, which is really a whole set of transformations in African-American culture. But one of the things that happened during the 1920s and the so-called Harlem Renaissance was that African-Americans began to look towards African and African diaspora influences and particularly were attracted to a kind of primitivism that they saw in African life and culture. And that's a reorientation that's going to make them look back on somebody like Burt Williams and this kind of urbane popular culture, which drew its inspirations from other sources. In any case, the generation of the Harlem Renaissance generation was going to look back on that, and that wasn't what they were interested in either. And then when you get to the 1950s and 1960s and the emergence of a kind of black nationalist ethos, looking at an artist like Burt Williams, who was an African American who actually performed in blackface, that wasn't going to be appealing.
Well, I need to take a break. I want to hold on to that moment about this black guy performing in blackface and how that related to what else was going on at this time period. I'm visiting with Professor Fitz Brundage about the book that he edited, Beyond Blackface, and I'll be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about the African-American entertainers and athletes and the other people who performed in the period around the turn of the century, and it's in the context of a new book published by UNC Press called Beyond Blackface. It's edited by our own history professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Fitzhugh Brundage. And before the break, we were just beginning to talk about this sort of getting into the minstrel culture in which white people put on black faces and this minstrel culture, which lasted for a long time. And one of the heroes of your essay in the book is this guy, Burt Williams. And he was a great entertainer. He was black. But as you were getting ready to point out, he also performed in blackface. Mm-hmm. And he was a light-skinned black guy, but to perform, he'd put on black makeup. Mm-hmm. So he'd be black. Now, I still don't understand that.
Well, I think it speaks to expectations that when his career started to take off in the mid-1890s, there were so few black performers on stages before white audiences. And I should back up and say he started his career in California and migrated back across to the East Coast, to Cleveland, Ohio, and then eventually to New York. And as he made his way across the U.S., performing in all manner of venues, he discovered that white audiences were used to seeing performers in blackface, and that to see a black man perform who wasn't in blackface doing comedic skits was apparently jarring. And so I suppose it would be as though, I was trying to think of an analogy, imagine seeing a kind of country music show like Hee Haw, where somebody had a New Jersey accent or a Long Island accent instead of a Southern accent. It just wouldn't work. But if that same person then put on a Southern accent, it'd be like, oh, that clicked, and it might become popular. But it really was his performing in blackface had to do with the expectations of the audiences. Now, the thing is that he continued to perform in blackface as his career went on. And there, now, it's one of the funny things about why did he have to do that? And this is sheer speculation because he left no personal papers. But I think part of it also was this was a distancing mechanism for him. It, of course, had been for whites who put on blackface and then acted black, so to speak. But for him, he was a very sophisticated, learned, erudite man. And he played characters who tended to be down-and-out bums of one kind or another. Smart, crafty, but nevertheless down-and-out bums. And so putting on blackface, putting on his attire, this was a persona that he took on. The challenge, of course, was this was a persona that if he hadn't been as skilled as he was, could have fulfilled white expectations of black stereotypes.
Yeah, well, it's real interesting. The movie of him in blackface, in which he is performing as a mime, I realized that the blackface helped him emphasize the eye movements so that it worked in some respects to enhance the performance. And I was struggling to try to find some other reason that he might put on a blackface other than he wanted to put on a blackface in some respects just because he would be disguised as a white person. He would be just the same as a white person mm-hmm. in blackface. It
yes,
erased the color barrier.
You're right, yeah. And he, it is important that think about blackface was when whites did blackface, they often did it in ways to accentuate kind of grotesque exaggerations of African-American features. If anyone has a chance to see pictures of Burt Williams, they'll see his blackface, practically speaking, doesn't exaggerate his lips. It just makes him darker because he was, as you said, light-skinned. But it's not one of those cases where as white performers often would have exaggerated lips and they would make themselves exceedingly dark. And one thinks of Al Jolson, for example, who performed in blackface, of course, in the first talking movie that was popular in the United States, The Jazz Singer. His blackface looks nothing like the blackface that Burt Williams wore.
Yep. Well, listen, lots more to talk about, but I haven't asked you the question that I really wanted to ask, and that is, how do you summarize the sort of results of this experience of the African American entertainers, both in terms of the movement towards equality and also the conditioning of America as a whole in terms of how its American culture developed. Have you got an elevator mm-hmm. speech for that?
Well, sort of. I think what attracts me to this group is that because African Americans occupied such a difficult position, not just politically, socially, economically, but culturally, that they were expected to be a primitive, debased people in the eyes of whites, and yet they obviously were not that. They had to find ways to use the culture that was the popular culture that was available to them to try to express everything that mattered to them. And I think if you look across the 20th century, what is remarkable is the ways in which African American performers and consumers, because of course African American consumers are important because these performers wouldn't have had a job if somebody didn't listen to them or buy their work. But these performers found a way to create this incredibly rich and very malleable, flexible culture that can be listened to because it's fun, because you enjoy listening to it, but it can also be listened to at a very, shall we say, very earnest level because these people are trying to express the human condition through popular culture. We take that for granted now, but that wasn't always the case.
Well, that might be a good place to end. I hate to end it because I'm learning it every minute as our conversation has continued with Professor Fitzhugh Brundage, the editor of Beyond Blackface, African Americans and the Creation of American Popular Culture, 1890 to 1930. Thanks, Fitz.
Thank you.
And thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking. I'll be right back here before you know it.